Chapter 8 Twin Forts. From the outbreak of the war, Abraham Lincoln recognized the pivotal role of Kentucky, a centrally located buffer state between North and South. "I hope to have God on my side," he admonished colleagues, "but I must have Kentucky." Another time he reflected, "I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game." With Kentucky, Confederates would be camped on the Ohio River, positioned to strike the North. And with Kentucky gone, Maryland and Missouri might follow suit, weighting the scales to Southern victory. Although nominally on the Union side, Kentucky turned into a state of wavering loyalty, bitterly riven in its tendencies. Much as in neighboring Missouri, homegrown secessionists flocked to state guard regiments organized by Governor Beriah McGoffin, while Unionists manned their home guard counterparts. Despite his southern inclinations, McGoffin warned both the Union and the Confederacy that any violation of Kentucky's neutrality would push his state into the opposing camp. Despite covert support to Kentucky Unionists, Lincoln carefully upheld the pose of neutrality, forbidding Union commanders from invading the state. The Confederacy blundered by invading Kentucky first, the interloper being a man of the cloth, Major General Leonidas Polk. Tall, with silvery hair, a broad face, and sideburns, Polk had attended West Point only to renounce his military career and become an Episcopal bishop in Louisiana. When the war started, his West Point friend Jefferson Davis lured the fighting bishop back into military uniform. When Polk dispatched Brigadier General Gideon J. Pillow to seize Columbus on the Mississippi River in Kentucky's southwest corner, he was immediately upbraided by superiors and told to withdraw, but he had correctly guessed that Grant planned to advance on the town, which marked the intersection of a key railroad with the Mississippi River. After Confederate forces threw a chain across the river to obstruct navigation and installed 140 guns on its steep bluffs, Columbus, for a time, constituted a more important Confederate fortress on the Mississippi than Vicksburg itself. If taking Columbus seemed a masterstroke from a military standpoint, it counted as a colossal political error. It destroyed any pretense of Kentucky neutrality, incited the state legislature to a more belligerent unionism, and opened the way for Union forces to march into the state under a banner of liberation. Now free to enter Kentucky, with an irresistible opportunity to make his mark, Grant eyed a prize much greater than Columbus: Paducah. On September 5th, a Union spy imparted crucial information. Confederate forces were preparing to move on Paducah, which stood about 45 miles northeast of Cairo. Speed meant everything. The town lay at the juncture of the Ohio and Tennessee rivers, making it the perfect springboard for securing Confederate territory. No less important, it stood near the confluence of the Ohio and Cumberland rivers and was thus the linchpin for river traffic in the whole area. The seizure of Paducah would also sever Confederate supply lines and isolate the high fortifications at Columbus. Before moving on the town, Grant telegraphed Fremont twice that he intended to launch the operation at 6:30 p.m. The deadline expired without any response from Fremont. In a high state of nervous tension, Grant delayed his start until 10 p.m. "I can wait no longer," he said at last. "I will go if it costs me my commission." Although Grant had anticipated Fremont's wish, he acted solely on his own initiative. For a man long crippled by doubt and stalled in his life, it was a step of breathtaking audacity, displaying a more forceful, direct, and aggressive Grant. He herded two well-equipped regiments and an artillery battery aboard steamers and headed up the Ohio River, escorted by two gunboats. If this mission failed, responsibility fell on his shoulders alone. As he approached Paducah, he beheld a town awash with Confederate flags in anticipation of the arrival of Confederate troops, but the quick-witted Grant beat them to the punch, and the town fell without a shot. The political dimension of the operation proved far trickier, since Grant needed to reassure a civilian population traumatized by his advent of his peaceful intentions. I never after saw such consternation depicted on the faces of the people. Men, women, and children came out of their doors looking pale and frightened at the presence of the invader. To pacify them, Grant issued a proclamation boldly written in the first person. He cleverly assumed that he was addressing loyal people and made common cause with them. "I have come among you not as an enemy, but as your friend and fellow citizen, not to injure or annoy you, but to respect the rights and to defend and enforce the rights of all loyal citizens. An enemy in rebellion against our common government has taken possession of and planted its guns upon the soil of Kentucky and fired upon our flag. He is moving upon your city. I am here to defend you against this enemy and to assert and maintain the authority and sovereignty of your government and mine." For the first time, Grant demonstrated his fine political tact and a command of the English language that would assist his success. He only stayed in Paducah for a day, leaving behind strict instructions that occupying soldiers should refrain from plunder and respect the rights of residents. When Lincoln set eyes on Grant's proclamation, he was impressed. "The modesty and brevity of that address shows that the officer issuing it understands the situation and is a proper man to command there at this time." Elihu Washburne touted Grant for Major General, reporting to him from Washington that his Paducah actions had attracted the attention of the president and met with his approval. The combined movements of Polk at Columbus and Grant at Paducah led the Kentucky legislature to demand the expulsion of Confederate forces from the state. Grant was buoyed by his sudden triumph. "You have seen my move upon Paducah, Kentucky," he wrote to Julia. "It was of much greater importance than is probably generally known." It was not in Grant's nature to boast, but the reversal in his fortunes was so startling he could scarcely resist. "I suppose you have seen from the papers that I have quite an extensive and important command. It is third in importance in the country, and General Fremont seems desirous of retaining me in it." Exuberantly confident, he asked Julia to send their son Fred to join him for the campaign. Not long after the town surrendered, Julia went to Paducah and had a conversation that shows her speedy conversion into an ardent Unionist. She told a female resident, "It is dreadful. Why, this mania for secession seems to be epidemic throughout the South." To which the woman retorted, "Mania, mania, madam, epidemic. Madam, why, the whole South has gone raving mad." After Paducah, Grant yearned to move on Columbus, but he could not obtain Fremont's approval or even elicit a reply. By November 1st, he would have 20,000 well-trained men and was eager to use them, but he had to endure a lull in the fighting. He was still frightfully busy with paperwork at Cairo, even if now helped by Rawlins and a competent staff, and he stayed up until 2 every morning, responding to mail. On September 13th, he received word that his brother Simpson had died of tuberculosis near St. Paul, Minnesota, and he was profoundly saddened. The body was shipped to his own house in Galena before the burial, which was attended by Jesse Grant and his daughters. Ulysses was too busy to join them, and Jesse sent him Simpson's watch as a keepsake. "I want to preserve it to the last day of my life," Grant told Julia, "and want my children to do the same thing in remembrance of poor Simp, who carried it in his lifetime." In late October, General Fremont took the field in Missouri against Major General Sterling Price, the former governor of the state. Grant rushed troops to help him and sent 3,000 men under Colonel Oglesby to pursue M. Jeff Thompson as well. On November 5th, he received word that the Confederate garrison at Columbus intended to divert troops to Price. Thus, to protect Union forces in Missouri, Grant decided to undertake an operation against Belmont, a small, muddy Missouri town with a steamboat landing that was controlled by the enemy and stood directly across the Mississippi from Columbus. Unlike other Union generals, who freely invented excuses for inaction, the restless Grant always scanned the horizon for reasons to fight. "There is but very little doubt that we can hold this place," he told Julia from Cairo. "What I want is to advance." At first, he was only supposed to make a demonstration against Belmont and Columbus, that is, harass and distract the Confederates. Then, after learning on November 6th about Fremont's dismissal, he took advantage of the momentary confusion to initiate more decisive action. After his hard knocks during the pre-war period, one might have expected him to be pessimistic, cautious, and self-doubting. Instead, he was becoming the most self-confident of Union commanders, perhaps needing to wipe away the stigma of earlier failures in civilian life, failures that had implanted in him a high level of motivation that no other general could quite match. Now swinging into action, Grant poured 5 regiments, about 3,000 men, onto 4 transports, accompanied by 2 wooden gunboats, and moved to within 6 miles of Columbus. The transports were so overloaded that Grant had to sleep on a deck chair on the ship. Then, at 2 in the morning on November 7th, Grant learned that rebel troops were being ferried across the Mississippi from Columbus to Belmont, troops that might operate against Colonel Oglesby in his hot pursuit of Thompson in Missouri. The report proved inaccurate. When setting out from Cairo, Grant had no idea that he was about to blaze into aggressive action. But keenly attuned to the psychology of his men, he feared they had grown dangerously restive in the fetid, unhealthy atmosphere of Cairo and knew a battle would revitalize their energy. Not long after dawn, Grant and his men sailed down the Mississippi and disembarked a few miles upstream from Belmont on the river's west side. "The early autumnal morning was delightful," wrote Dr. Brinton, "the air fresh and invigorating, without being cold. Since it would be impossible to hold terrain, with Confederate guns frowning down on them across the river, Grant expected to make a lightning strike and asked his soldiers to carry a mere 2 days' rations in their haversacks. This was the first time Grant presided over a full army in combat, and many of his untested men were newcomers to battle. He marched them toward Belmont, guided them through clearings and dense forests, then formed them into clear lines. Once General Polk got wind of Grant's move, he swiftly parried the advance, moving 5 regiments to hold off the Union incursion. Around 9 a.m., when they met enemy regiments under General Pillow, Grant's units reacted with tremendous esprit de corps. They obeyed his orders with great alacrity," he said, "the men all showing great courage. Union soldiers clambered over brush and fallen timber, chasing Confederates through the thick woods in a furiously contested fight. Buoyed by high spirits, the youthful soldiers began to fire indiscriminately at the rebels. 'Stop the men!' Grant yelled on horseback at Rawlins. 'They are wasting ammunition!' Even leather-lunged Rawlins couldn't make himself heard above the din, so Grant galloped close to officers, leaned down, and hollered in their ears, 'Don't fire till you see somebody, and then take good aim!' He didn't yet trust his subordinates or know their skills, and had to perform many tasks he later delegated to others. Grant's horse was shot from under him, and he swapped it for another. Swept up in the whirlwind of battle, he stayed cool-headed and composed, manifesting a fierce tenacity. He also showed he was fully prepared to share risks with his men and inspire them by his presence. When they encountered a long line of felled trees with sharpened points, a so-called abatis, Union forces smashed through these defenses, throwing the startled rebels back against the riverbank. After 4 hours of torrid fighting, the rebel withdrawal broke down into a disorderly rout. Suddenly, to their astonishment, Grant's men possessed the Confederate camp, strewn with food, baggage, and artillery. This unexpected conquest was too tempting for novice soldiers, and discipline collapsed on the spot. Flushed with victory, transported by powerful emotions, the men began to plunder the site for trophies, sent up cheers, declaimed premature speeches, and generally acted as if the battle had ended. Grant could not stop them from crowing over their feet, his sound strategy undone by this amateur behavior. In stopping to exult and loot the camp, his men failed to pursue the Confederates, who flocked to the riverbank and regrouped. Soon, rebels began to creep back toward the camp, this time strongly reinforced from Columbus. I saw two steamers coming from the Columbus side toward the west shore above us, black or gray with soldiers from boiler deck to roof, said Grant. Faced with this ominous sight, he futilely tried to get his men to shoot at the steamers. When this failed, he ordered the camp set ablaze. No longer worried about hitting their own soldiers, Confederate cannoneers firing from the Columbus Heights rained down shells on Grant's troops, who went from rejoicing to sheer terror as they thought themselves surrounded. They had snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Grant stemmed the panic, recalling, "When I announced that we had cut our way in and could cut our way out just as well, it seemed a new revelation to officers and soldiers." Averting disaster, he reversed the psychology of the moment, leading his men to carve out an avenue of escape and battle their way back to safety aboard their steamboat transports. Extricated from danger, petrified Union soldiers rushed pell-mell onto the waiting boats. As one mate remembered, "They rushed across to the other side of the boat till she listed over, so that one wheel went whirling around uselessly in the air." After supervising the embarkation of wounded soldiers, Grant scouted the area on horseback, checking on guards he had posted to prevent attacks on the transports. To his surprise, the guards had fled. As he crossed a cornfield, he came within view of General Polk, who advised his riflemen, "There is a Yankee. You may try your marksmanship on him if you wish." Luckily for Grant, nobody fired. The boats were about to push off when one captain, his boat's smokestack blasted with bullets, spied Grant on the steep riverbank, waiting to come aboard. For a moment it was unclear how he could do this, since the boat had cut its lines and floated slightly offshore. "My horse put his forefeet over the bank without hesitation or urging," Grant wrote, "and with his hind feet well under him, slid down the bank and trotted aboard the boat 12 or 15 feet away over a single gangplank." It was an exquisite display of horsemanship by Grant, who characteristically credited the horse. Grant lay down on a sofa in the captain's stateroom when he was startled by a fusillade of rebel musketry. As he went to inspect the situation, a bullet flew through the room and struck the sofa where he had just been. It was the harrowing conclusion of a day of heavy fighting. On the trip back to Cairo, the officers dined and engaged in animated discussion, while Grant, with customary sang-froid, officiated in silence at the head of the table. "We thought he was hard-hearted, cold, and indifferent," noted one soldier, "but it was only the difference between a real soldier and amateur soldiers." Deriving considerable pride from his troops' behavior at Belmont, Grant praised them the next day, saying he had been in all the battles fought in Mexico by General Scott and Taylor, save Buena Vista, and never saw one more hotly contested or where troops behaved with more gallantry. He had broken up the enemy camp at Belmont and unleashed the animal spirits of his men, imbuing them with lasting confidence. Indeed, Belmont damaged the mystique that Confederate soldiers were always fearless and fought to the bitter end. After the battle, Leonidas Polk proudly informed Jefferson Davis of the complete rout of Union forces, transmitting an erroneous report that General Grant is reportedly killed. From a purely statistical standpoint, the bloody battle was a narrow Union victory against overwhelming Confederate numbers. Grant suffered 80 killed, 322 wounded, and 54 missing, versus 105 killed, 419 wounded, and 117 missing for the rebels. Grant and Rawlins believed they had averted Confederate mischief in Missouri. "Belmont is entirely abandoned by the enemy," Rawlins wrote, "and thus the southeastern portion of Missouri is without a rebel army." As days passed and Grant heard that Memphis was plunged into mourning, its largest hotel converted into a hospital for Belmont casualties, his sense of the magnitude of his victory grew. He collected his first positive notices in the national press, the New York Times saluting Belmont as "in high degree creditable to all our troops concerned in it, and the success of the brilliant movement is due to General Grant." On a personal level, Belmont was Grant's baptism of fire. He had shown a boldness bordering on impetuosity and a preternatural coolness under fire. He had improvised new solutions when the original battle plan went awry, a key mark of military leadership. Belmont probably removed any doubts about himself that he had carried over from civilian life. It certainly advanced his standing in Washington, where Washburn kept Lincoln minutely apprised of his achievements. On November 20th, Grant informed Washburn that the Confederate loss at Belmont proves to be greater and the effect upon the Southern mind more saddening. Washburn rushed this commentary into Lincoln's hands, saying, "I want you to take a moment's time to read this letter of General Grant." Speculation was rife that Grant would be promoted to Major General. When a relative told Julia Grant that her husband should be content with a Brigadier General's rank, she grew indignant. "There is no danger of his reaching a position above his capacity," she insisted. "He is equal to a much higher one than this, and will certainly win it if he lives." Grant's modest Belmont victory was not an unalloyed success. Perhaps thinking of that battle, he later observed, "In the beginning of the war, we all did things more rashly than later." He had exceeded his instructions and carried out a costly raid that neither seized territory nor captured an army. One Northern officer jeered that Belmont was called a victory, but if such be victory, God save us from defeat. Military historians have faulted Grant for not providing sufficient guards for transports, for failing to block the arrival of Confederate reinforcements from Columbus, and for not incorporating the two gunboats into his overall strategy. Belmont also previewed one of Grant's few salient weaknesses. Intent on his own offensive strategy, he often failed to anticipate countermoves from opposing generals, leaving him vulnerable to dramatic surprises. And Belmont was not the last time he was blindsided by the enemy. On the same day as the Belmont battle, Julia Grant beheld in her bedroom a grave apparition of her husband that shook her to the roots. As she recounted, "I only saw his head and shoulders, about as high as if he were on horseback." The wraith stared down at her in earnest reproach. Both Julia and Ulysses Grant were still avowed believers in dreams and portents. Reacting to this vision, Julia gathered up the children and left that evening for Cairo, where Grant met her at the train station. "I told him of my seeing him on the day of the battle. He asked at what hour, and when I told him, he said, 'That is singular. Just about that time I was on horseback and in great peril, and I thought of you and the children, and what would become of you if I were lost.'" Julia was less than smitten with the town. "I remember how high and angry the river was, and how desolate Cairo seemed." Nor was she satisfied by their house, which resembled a great barracks. She also didn't warm to the lengthy beard, cut square at the bottom, that her husband now sported, and she had him trim it closer, giving him a somewhat neater look for the rest of the war. Grant had finally reached a plateau high enough to suit the social vanity of Julia and her family. Earlier, when Grant was sent to Mexico or posted to the western frontier, Julia and her father had criticized the military life. Now Julia's heart beat faster at waving flags and the rhythmic tread of troops on parade grounds. She was overcome by the abrupt elevation of her husband's status. How proud I was hearing the bands play Hail to the Chief as my general rode down the columns inspecting. Nothing could be more interesting, more thrilling, than to see these columns of brave men in motion. For the rest of the war, Julia Grant, the slave owner's daughter, would be heart and soul for the Union Army. With no major battle in the offing, Grant showed commendable zeal in ferreting out corruption and disloyalty he saw spreading around him. He believed the lower Mississippi River was crawling with steamship employees working for the Confederacy and wanted to shut down river traffic south of nearby Cape Girardeau. There is not a sufficiency of Union sentiment left in this portion of the state to save Sodom, he declared. As part of his anti-corruption campaign, he ordered the arrest of the district quartermaster and his chief clerk, informing Washington that I also had all the books and papers of the department seized and locked up in the safe, and the key kept in custody of a member of my staff. A schemer all his life, Jesse Root Grant could not comprehend his son's ethical purity. Now that Ulysses could be useful to him, he professed to find new virtues in him. I know that Ulysses was never worth anything in business, he told an associate. It's because he's all soldier, Ulysses is. First, Jesse sought to exploit his son's standing to obtain a position for a friend, sending Ulysses into a rage. I do not want to be importuned for places, he protested. I have none to give and want to be placed under no obligation to anyone. Next, his father sought help in landing a Union Army contract to furnish harnesses. I cannot take an active part in securing contracts, Grant lectured his father. It is necessary both to my efficiency for the public good and my own reputation that I should keep clear of government contracts. As Grant cracked down on illicit trade between northern merchants and southern suppliers, his father lobbied for a commercial pass for yet another friend. It is entirely out of the question to pass persons south, he told him in exasperation. We have many Union men sacrificing their lives now from exposure as well as battle, and it is necessary for the security of the thousands still exposed that all communication should be cut off between the two sections. Jesse Grant never quite grasped that his incorruptible son refused to be a party to his self-interested schemes. On November 19, 1861, Major General Henry W. Halleck succeeded Fremont as commander of the renamed Department of the Missouri, which also encompassed western Kentucky and Arkansas. Fremont had fallen victim to corruption allegations as well as Lincoln's emphatic displeasure with his ill-timed Emancipation Proclamation. The rest of the western command, including Tennessee and the rest of Kentucky, would now fall to the Department of the Ohio under the command of Don Carlos Buell. In Washington, the military boy wonder, 34-year-old George B. McClellan, had superseded the aging Winfield Scott to become field commander of the Army of the Potomac and the youngest general-in-chief in American history. The conservative McClellan stressed to Halleck that the war was being fought solely to preserve the Union, and had nothing to do with freeing slaves. As a result, Halleck banned fugitive slaves from Union camps under his command, and Grant duly obeyed. Halleck was a pudgy, odd-looking fellow with a high forehead, balding pate, heavy eye pouches, and bulging, slightly crossed eyeballs. Because of his goggle eye, he often seemed to stare over the shoulder of interlocutors. A brusque, crotchety loner, he often offended people with his peevish remarks. He gave off a strangely uncouth air. One journalist portrayed him as a short, countrified person who picked his teeth walking up and down the halls at Willard's Hotel and argued through a white, bilious eye and a huge mouth. Lincoln's secretary, John Hay, mocked Halleck's uniform as a little white at the seams and seedy at the buttonholes, and said he had a stooped and downward glance. Halleck had worked as a corporation lawyer and mining expert in San Francisco before the war. Even those who disliked him admired his erudition. By the Civil War, he had left behind a rich trove of writing on warfare and international law. His textbook, Elements of Military Art and Science, was virtually required reading at West Point, and he had also translated from French into English a 4-volume biography of Napoleon. So daunting was his knowledge of military lore that when he was later dubbed Old Brains, the nickname stuck. Unluckily for Grant, Halleck was strictly an armchair, by-the-book general. Steeped in the theory of war, he lacked Grant's visceral instinct for fighting. Halleck was a soldier in his brain, whereas Grant was a soldier in his marrow. By nature a spectator, Halleck was the sort of military bureaucrat who preferred to keep a safe distance from the battlefield. He severely punished army infractions and kept a tight rein on subordinates. He carped at generals in a way that offended rather than motivated them. At first taken with him, Lincoln came to view Halleck as a paper pusher who ducked tough decisions in the field. Hay later encapsulated Halleck's conduct by saying he hates responsibility, hates to give orders, while Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles groused that he suggests nothing, is good for nothing. Such insights still lay in the future, however. And for the moment, Halleck was riding high, winning the admiration of Grant, Sherman, and other generals. The overworked Grant worried that Halleck would ditch him in favor of a personal favorite. "I am somewhat troubled lest I lose my command here," he confided to his father, "though I believe my administration has given general satisfaction not only to those over me but to all concerned." While proud of his men's hard-earned discipline, he found himself bogged down in minutiae. He was short on transportation, grumbled about inferior uniforms, and protested the dated flintlock muskets he received. 8 companies are entirely without arms of any description," he complained. Grant persisted in his crusade against profiteering, annulling overpriced contracts that added up to 30% to prices paid by the government. Instead of sweetheart deals, he favored open, competitive bidding. Grant's honesty won him a host of business enemies who sought revenge by any means. One disaffected contractor was Captain William J. Kuntz, hired by the government to buy, charter, and operate boats for transporting troops on the Ohio River. 31 Cairo boatmen protested his appointment, claiming a more unpopular man with all classes of boatmen could not have been selected. Grant suspected irregularities in Kuntz's handling of this business, and after a violent argument, he and Rawlins tossed the quarrelsome captain from the room. On January 14, 1862, Grant ordered Kuntz's arrest for disobedience of orders and disrespect to his superior officer. After 14 days stewing in the brig, the venomous Kuntz retaliated against Grant with blistering charges about his allegedly drunken behavior. After Belmont, Grant had met his Confederate counterparts aboard a steamer under a flag of truce to work out burial arrangements for dead soldiers and prisoner exchanges. During one such meeting, Kuntz declared, "Grant became, by the use of intoxicating liquors, beastly drunk." Writing to Washington, Kuntz laid down sensational charges. He accused Grant of drinking with traitors and enemies to the federal government while under a flag of truce, of occupying the cook's room on a government steamer while under a flag of truce and vomiting all over the floor, and of getting drunk at the St. Charles Hotel and losing his sword and uniform. He further accused Grant of visiting a drunken harlot at her private hotel room, drunkenly attending a Negro ball with AIDS, and getting so drunk that he had to go upstairs on all fours, conduct not becoming a man. Kuntz demanded an investigation, if not a court-martial, of Grant. Grant was never investigated and thought it best not to dignify such vitriol with a response. One Grant colleague scoffed at the allegations. "I saw Grant after he came back from Belmont. He was sober as a judge." It is tempting to write off Kuntz's allegations as the baseless ravings of a vindictive man. While there is clearly a large element of grotesque exaggeration in his statements, they loosely conform to a pattern of wartime drinking charges against Grant. These sporadic episodes often occurred in the aftermath of large battles, when Grant could afford to relax and take short side trips, and when neither Rawlins nor Julia was present. The Kuntz charges find echoes in a letter by William Brose of the Chicago Tribune, a passionate Lincoln supporter, to Secretary of War Simon Cameron. On December 30, 1861, 2 weeks before Kuntz's arrest, Brose wrote that General U.S. Grant commanding at Cairo is an inebriate. The enclosed anonymous letter would not deserve a moment's attention were there not facts abundant from other sources that what the letter writer says is true. The anonymous writer accused Grant of being perfectly inebriate under a flag of truce with rebels. The writer also detected grumbling in Cairo about Julia Grant bringing a slave into camp. Until we can secure pure men in habits and men without secessionist wives with their own little slaves to wait upon them, which is a fact here in this camp with Mrs. Grant, our country is lost. Brose's warning landed on the president's desk. On January 4th, Lincoln penned atop it, "Brose would not knowingly misrepresent. General Grant was appointed chiefly on the recommendation of Honorable E.B. Washburn. Perhaps we should consult him." The War Secretary forwarded the letter to Washburn, who needed no prompting in the matter. He had just received a message from Benjamin H. Campbell of Galena, who had heard similar reports of Grant drinking on a recent trip to St. Louis. "I am sorry to hear from good authority that General Grant is drinking very hard. Had you not better write to Rawlins to know the fact?" Washburn dashed off a concerned letter to Rawlins, inquiring about liquor drinking in high places. In reply, Rawlins stated in an outraged tone that he was astounded at the contents of Washburn's note. "I would say unequivocally and emphatically that the statement that General Grant is drinking very hard is utterly untrue and could have originated only in malice. When I came to Cairo, General Grant was, as he is today, a strictly total abstinence man, and I have been informed by those who knew him well that such has been his habit for the last 5 or 6 years." He noted Grant's extraordinary productivity as a commander. He even wrote his own reports, and said an intemperate man could never accomplish this. Rawlins provided a detailed account of every drop of liquor Grant had touched. Because of stomach trouble, a physician had prescribed 2 glasses of ale or beer daily, but Grant had never exceeded that amount. Rawlins also mentioned that Grant drank with visiting friends at the St. Charles Hotel, a detail mentioned by Kuntz, but in no instance did he drink enough to manifest it to anyone who did not see him drink. Grant had also enjoyed 1/2 glass of champagne with a visiting railroad president, but right after that, he voluntarily stated he should not, during the continuance of the war, again taste liquor of any kind. Rawlins concluded his message with a melodramatic flourish. "No one can feel a greater interest in General Grant than I do. I regard his interest as my interest. I love him as a father. I respect him because I have studied him well, and the more I know him, the more I respect and love him. Knowing the truth, I am willing to trust my hopes of the future upon his bravery and temperate habits. I say to you frankly, and I pledge you my word for it, that should General Grant at any time become an intemperate man or an habitual drunkard, I will notify you immediately, will ask to be removed from duty on his staff, kind as he has been to me, or resign my commission." Already Rawlins functioned as Grant's protector as well as watchdog. Before sending the reply to Washburn, he showed it to Grant, who perused it closely. "Yes, that's right, exactly right," he told Rawlins. "Send it by all means." A month later, William Rowley waded into the controversy, asserting to Washburn that anyone who accused Grant of becoming dissipated was either misinformed or else he lies. Grant is the same cool, energetic, and unassuming man that you supposed him to be. In general, Julia Grant avoided any mention of her husband's drinking, although she noted the confrontation between Grant and Captain Kuntz in her memoirs. Of course, Captain Kuntz was very angry and at once proclaimed broadcast that General Grant and his staff were all drunk. Despite the varied drinking anecdotes about Grant, they possess one common denominator. Julia Grant was absent when they supposedly happened. Late in life, Grant told Mrs. Leland Stanford how Julia had cured him of drinking. Once, when they were traveling together, a friend had sent him a small keg of fine whiskey, which he stood on a washstand. As Mrs. Stanford related the tale, that night the general was awakened by a noise and found that Mrs. Grant was up. Asked what the gurgling noise was, she told him that she had drawn the stopper and was letting the whiskey run down the drain pipe to prevent him from drinking it. He declared this cured him of the habit. On December 23, 1861, Grant notified his troops that he now headed the new district of Cairo, which would encompass southern Illinois, some southern Missouri counties, and western Kentucky. Though he was swamped with paperwork, his real passion lay in planning future battles. His troops were now fully outfitted, and he marveled at the size of the army under his aegis. "I have now a larger force than General Scott ever commanded, prior to our present difficulties," he told his sister. "I do hope it will be my good fortune to retain so important a command for at least one battle." His command now extended to the mouths of the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers in northwest Tennessee, two large tributaries of the Ohio River that would enable him to infiltrate the Confederacy. To exploit this required close coordination with the Navy, and Grant would benefit from the steadfast cooperation of Flag Officer Andrew Hull Foote, who supervised the gunboat flotilla. Born in New Haven, Connecticut, Foote had dark hair, a piercing eye, a clean-shaven upper lip, and a full beard. He was a faithful member of the Congregational Church, whose piety spilled over into his political views. He hated slavery and had patrolled the African coast years earlier as part of a Navy campaign against the slave trade. On Sunday mornings, he offered sermons on his ships. No less than Grant, he detested swearing. The puritanical Foote was forever on the warpath against drinking, having, years earlier, extracted temperance pledges from men on his ships. With his blunt, salty manner, he was the perfect Navy counterpart to Grant, sharing his aggressive instincts and preferring to take the war to the enemy. In the absence of smooth institutional arrangements between the Army and the Navy early in the war, Foote and Grant managed to forge a harmonious working relationship. In the fall of 1861, Foote dispatched a reconnaissance mission to ascertain Confederate defenses along the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers. Despite potent Union sentiment in its eastern portion, Tennessee had seceded in June. The Confederate general Albert Sidney Johnston had to defend a long east-west line that stretched from Missouri to Bowling Green, Kentucky, to the Cumberland Gap. The two parallel rivers represented the soft underbelly of his defensive shield. As a result, the Confederacy hastily constructed Fort Henry on the east bank of the Tennessee and Fort Donelson on the west bank of the Cumberland, twin fortresses a dozen miles apart. The capture of one fort might quickly topple the other, and Johnston fretted about their exposed condition, inadequate manpower, and unfinished state. Though he sensed a catastrophe in the making, he felt powerless to stop it in time, despite a multitude of rushed warnings to subordinates. Johnston worried for good reasons. Control of Fort Henry would create a river pathway for Union forces, laying bare a broad swath of rebel territory as far south as Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Control of Fort Donelson would render Nashville vulnerable to Union forces. After General Charles F. Smith made a demonstration against Fort Henry, he returned to Grant on January 22nd with a hopeful verdict for an assault. "I think two ironclad gunboats would make short work of Fort Henry." Grant required little convincing. "Well, if it can be taken," he declared, "it should be without delay." Contemplating his next action, Grant chafed at Halleck's hidebound style. On January 6th, he had requested permission to travel to St. Louis to see Halleck and present plans for the conquest of Forts Henry and Donelson, but not until January 23rd did he secure permission for a four-day visit. Halleck had an abrupt, brusque style, according to William Tecumseh Sherman, and lost no time treating Grant in patronizing fashion, making clear who stood higher in the military hierarchy. Short-tempered, impatient, he shook Grant's hand coldly, resumed his seat, and told Grant to state briefly the nature of the business connected with your command which brought you to headquarters. Unfurling a map, Grant showed how 25,000 men, backed up by gunboats, could grab the two riverside forts. Halleck, having none of this, rudely interrupted him. "Is there anything connected with the good of your command you wish to discuss?" When Grant returned to his map, Halleck brushed him aside. "All of this, General Grant, relates to the business of the general commanding the department. When he wishes to consult you on that subject, he will notify you." Having pulled rank, Halleck stormed from the room while Grant stood nursing his wounds. "I was cut short as if my plan was preposterous," he wrote. "I returned to Cairo very much crestfallen." In his memoirs, Sherman gave Halleck credit for having already mapped out the general move against the Tennessee forts a month earlier, but Grant insisted he was first to spot the precise point of Confederate vulnerability. "My mind was made up from the time I went to Cairo, before Halleck assumed command of the department, where that point was." However impeccable in preparation, Halleck was slow and lumbering in execution, and did not appreciate the rapid tempo, daring decisions, and assertive nature of his gifted subordinate. He also fancied himself the authority on grand strategy, condescending to Grant as a lowly upstart. Historian John F. Marzalek suspects that Halleck viewed Grant through the lens of his troubled past in the antebellum army. Halleck knew all about Grant's reputation for having had a pre-war drinking problem in California, and unfounded rumors had reached Washington that Grant had recently fallen off the wagon. Grant's unkempt appearance did not help either. While Grant was in St. Louis, he stopped by Whitehaven, a plantation now depleted by runaway slaves, for a turkey dinner with Colonel Dent, who was in a more hospitable mood than previously. As they ate, Grant narrated for him the Belmont battle. A large contingent of Confederate sympathizers lurked in St. Louis and had formed an organization to funnel aid to rebels. One member had suggested kidnapping Grant and hauling him farther south as a valuable prisoner. It was testimony to Grant's popularity during his St. Louis years that the leaders rejected the idea. Back in Cairo, Grant conferred with Foote, who concurred in his plan to take Fort Henry. The two men decided to renew their entreaty for a bold move to Halleck, and Grant sent off a startling one-line telegram that exuded supreme confidence. "To Major General Halleck, with permission, I will take Fort McHenry on the Tennessee and hold and establish a large camp there." Grant's words were effective because of their extreme economy. On the same day, Foote sent a telegram to Halleck contending that troops, escorted by four ironclad gunboats, could seize the fort. Grant believed a prompt attack stood an excellent chance of success, and that delay would permit the Confederates to shore up the fort's shoddy defenses. To the surprise of Grant and Foote, Rawlins even banged his fist in spontaneous celebration. Halleck endorsed the campaign on January 30th. "Fort Henry should be taken and held at all hazards." The letter contained the principal reason for Halleck's sudden about-face. He had received startling intelligence from Washington that PGT Beauregard, accompanied by 15 regiments, was marching from Manassas to Kentucky to strengthen the lengthy defensive line that Halleck, Grant, and Foote wished to pierce. The intelligence proved mistaken. Beauregard was heading there alone, not with troops. But the error proved fruitful for Grant. In addition to news about Beauregard, Halleck may also have felt pressure from Lincoln, who was annoyed by jockeying for position between Halleck and Buell and the resulting inaction. "Delay is ruining us," Lincoln warned both generals. "It is indispensable for me to have something definite." After receiving a dispatch from Halleck making excuses for his lethargy, Lincoln poured out his frustration to Quartermaster General Montgomery Meigs. "General, what shall I do? The people are impatient. The bottom is out of the tub. What shall I do?" Lincoln read the Riot Act to his generals, ordering that land and naval forces ought to move against the insurgent forces by Washington's birthday on February 22nd. Among the forces specified for action was the Army and Flotilla at Cairo. The new War Secretary, Edwin Stanton, also hungered for action and had become disillusioned with the do-nothing McClellan, whose grandiosity concealed deep insecurity. Stanton wrote internally that, "As soon as I can get the machinery of office going, the rats cleared out and the rat holes stopped, we shall move. This army has got to fight or run away. The champagne and oysters on the Potomac must be stopped." Brimming with confidence, Grant prepared to take Fort Henry, employing 15,000 men and 9 gunboats under Flag Officer Foote. He proceeded with a secrecy that became a trademark of his operations, confiding in the fewest number of people. Even Grant's commanders were kept in the dark until the last moment. "I'm quietly making preparations for a move," he alerted Halleck, without as yet having created a suspicion even that a move is to be made. Striving to perfect a new style of swiftly mobile warfare, he planned to have the whole army travel lightly and elected to dispense with cumbersome baggage trains as well as cavalry for the high command. In general, Grant operated free from immediate oversight by Halleck, but the latter planted a spy with a mission to function as his eyes and ears. Halleck appointed Lieutenant Colonel James Birdseye McPherson of Ohio, 33, as the expedition's chief engineer, and he arrived with Halleck's instructions to Grant. After graduating first in his West Point class, McPherson had overseen fortifications on Alcatraz Island off San Francisco. If Halleck had intended to keep watch on Grant's rumored drinking, the plan soon boomeranged, for the bearded young McPherson quickly shifted loyalty to his new boss. Smart and handsome, he had an unusually keen grasp of military affairs and a far-sighted look of shrewdness in his eyes. He also had a pleasing way with people, and Grant soon viewed him as one of the finest gentlemen he had ever encountered. From the outset, Grant predicted McPherson would make one of the most brilliant officers in the service, and came to regard him as a virtual member of his family. When he boarded his flagship at Cairo on February 2nd to commence the Fort Henry campaign, the ordinarily imperturbable Grant seemed edgy, eager to overrun the fort before it was reinforced. Timing was always critical in his missions. Fearing that Halleck, at the last moment, might revoke his orders, he kept stealing backward glimpses at the wharf as his boat departed, as if a message might suddenly detain him. When Cairo disappeared behind him, Grant was so relieved that he cuffed Rawlins on the shoulder. Grant seldom behaved with such genial familiarity, and exclaimed, "Now we seem to be safe, beyond recall. We will succeed, Rawlins. We must succeed." On the rainy morning of February 3rd, 1862, Grant set off up the Tennessee River from Paducah, Kentucky, toward Fort Henry, leading a fearsome flotilla of 4 ironclad and 3 wooden gunboats that protected 23 regiments of Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa volunteers, who stood packed on transports. The new ironclads, designed by James B. Eads, rode low in the water, presenting a spectacle never seen before. They had thick armor plates welded to the bow and tilted sides to deflect flank shots. These humpbacked monsters were surprisingly nimble, with 13 guns apiece mounted on top. They proceeded with extreme precaution down a perilous river swimming with mines called torpedoes or infernal machines, which could blow even ironclads to smithereens. These devices bobbed unseen below the surface, each packed with 75 pounds of powder, and Foote's sailors delicately swept up and defused 8 of them before they exploded. Luckily, the swollen river put the boats beyond the reach of many submerged mines tethered to the river bottom in fixed positions. Always curious about new technology, Grant asked the ship's armorer to bring him a defused mine plucked from the river. When the man obliged, the device started to give off a threatening hiss, at which point several bystanders threw themselves flat on the deck or dove into the water. Grant and Foote bolted helter-skelter up the ship's ladder. When they reached the top, both felt a trifle foolish, and Foote inquired with a smile, "General, why this haste?" "That the Navy may not get ahead of us," Grant replied drolly. By then, the menacing hiss had ceased. By next morning, Grant had landed an entire division under Brigadier General John A. McClernand at a spot 3 miles below Fort Henry. Grant's force was so large that once the transports were emptied, he sent them steaming back to Paducah to bring forward the remaining troops under General Smith. He wanted to place his men at a staging area that offered quick access to Fort Henry, yet lay beyond the reach of its 17 powerful guns. For surprised Confederates at Fort Henry, smoke curling from the boats alerted them to the abrupt approach of danger. "Far as the eye could see," one wrote, "the course of the river could be traced by the dense volumes of smoke issuing from the flotilla." Brigadier General Lloyd Tilghman, the Confederate commander, hunkered down inside the fort instead of trying to disrupt Grant's landing. To figure out the range of Fort Henry's guns, Grant didn't leave matters to a team of officers, but showed personal bravery and involvement. He boarded the gunboat Essex, joined by 2 other gunboats, and the 3 ships crept slowly toward Fort Henry until they drew fire, establishing the precise trajectory of rebel weapons. 1 shot passed very near where Captain William Porter and I were standing, struck the deck near the stern, penetrated and passed through the cabin, and so out into the river, Grant wrote. Afterward, aboard the steamer Uncle Sam, Grant sent Julia a letter that gave a fine snapshot of his excited, self-assured state of mind. "The enemy are well fortified and have a strong force," he informed her. "I do not want to boast, but I have a confident feeling of success. You will soon hear if my presentiment is realized." Fort Henry's location represented a colossal miscalculation by the Confederates, for its natural features gave the advantage to attacking forces. When the river was swollen with rain, as now, buoyant enemy ships actually gazed down on its earthworks. As one Confederate captain put it, "We had a more dangerous force to contend with than the Federals, namely the river itself." Portions of the fort's low outlying grounds were submerged in 2-foot puddles. It had been a harebrained scheme to place a fort in this unsafe spot. Tilghman's men had to defend a 5-sided structure with antiquated weaponry that included hunting rifles brought by soldiers from their farms and flintlock muskets reminiscent of bygone wars. Many of the fort's heavy guns had to be retired because they blew up in preliminary tests or lacked suitable ammunition. Grant's strategy for seizing Fort Henry was simple but effective. Foote and his gunboats would first pummel the Confederates at close quarters. On the high ground opposite Fort Henry stood another thinly manned Confederate work called Fort Hyman. Grant would have General Smith and two brigades sneak up behind Hyman and occupy it. At the same time, General McClernand and an infantry division would envelop Fort Henry from behind, bottling up its defenders and preventing them from scampering to safety at nearby Fort Donelson. Perhaps nothing highlighted Grant's meteoric rise more than the fact that one of his main commanders, General Charles F. Smith, had been commandant of cadets when Grant attended West Point, having instructed him in infantry tactics. A stately figure with blue eyes and a handlebar mustache, Smith was a gentlemanly soldier, and Grant remained awed by his regal presence. He held Smith in such reverence that he found it hard to act as his superior. "It does not seem quite right for me to give General Smith orders," Grant admitted. "General, I am now a subordinate," Smith said graciously. "I know a soldier's duty. Pray feel no awkwardness whatever about our new relations." Instead of resenting that he had to answer to Grant, Smith reciprocated the high regard of his former cadet, fondly remembering him from academy days for his modesty, superior horsemanship, and proficiency in mathematics. He scoffed at stories about Grant's drinking as fables. "The public are all astray about General Grant. His habits, drink, are unexceptionable." On the night of February 5, 1862, Grant was stirred by the beautiful sight of Union campfires flickering on both sides of the Tennessee River. He issued orders for the attack against Fort Henry at 11 a.m. the next day, even though he was not absolutely certain that all his infantry would arrive in time. As always, Grant rated speed and timing as more important than having every soldier in perfect position. That he expected his army to roll over the enemy swiftly was apparent from his field order. "The troops will move with 2 days' rations of bread and meat in their haversacks." That night, heavy rains soaked the soldiers, many of whom slept outdoors without tents to shelter them. By the next day, rainy weather had transformed footpaths into bogs, impeding an infantry advance. At around 11 a.m., 4 ironclads began the journey toward Fort Henry, while 3 timberclads hung in the rear. Grant began to write orders so expeditiously that his hand ached. The orders were terse, hard-hitting. All 7 of Foote's ships unleashed maximum firepower on the rebels, who responded with deafening fire, scoring 80 hits on Union ships and inflicting special damage on Foote's ironclad flagship. Undeterred, Foote kept the remaining 3 ironclads roaring ahead, firing with prodigious ferocity. By the time they approached within 300 yards of Fort Henry, they had created such havoc inside the fort that Tilghman ran up a white flag. It had taken Foote's fleet little more than an hour to snuff out Confederate batteries, and Tilghman surrendered with his staff and 90 other men. Once inside the fort, the Union men stared in amazement at the horrifying damage they had wrought, with "mangled bodies, arms and legs and brains scattered all around," said a junior officer from Illinois. Foote's boats had prevailed over the fort's primitive artillery, while Grant's infantry still lagged in the rear, mired in mud and threading their way through dense forests. One infantryman probably spoke for many in saying that they "really felt sore at the sailors for their taking of the fort before we had a chance to help them." The sailors had performed the lion's share of the work, and by the time Grant arrived at 3 p.m., the Union flag had already fluttered above the fort for almost an hour. It was a stunning victory for new naval technology, mobilized by an old infantryman, U.S. Grant. Tilghman told Grant he had evacuated almost his entire garrison, some 2,500 of a total of 2,600, to Fort Donelson, leaving a skeletal crew of 100 men to stave off Union forces and allow time for these soldiers to escape. Other accounts claim that rebel defenders yielded to panic under fire, fleeing of their own accord. Setting his style for the rest of the war, Grant was mild-mannered in victory, although when he met Confederate officers, they felt the steely core beneath the surface. Captain Jesse Taylor, who greeted Grant on behalf of Tilghman, appraised him as a modest, amiable, kind-hearted, but resolute man. Grant magnanimously invited the Confederate officers to join his staff for meals aboard the steamer he had tapped as his headquarters. Taking Fort Henry was a spectacular breakthrough. "Fort Henry is ours," Halleck telegraphed to McClellan. "The flag of the Union is reestablished on the soil of Tennessee. It will never be removed." The North reacted ecstatically, the news feeding unreasonable hopes that the war might be wrapped up in short order. "A few more events, such as the capture of Fort Henry," the New York Tribune predicted, "and the war will be substantially at an end." Fort Henry served as a tonic to Lincoln's flagging spirits. As Naval Officer Henry Wise reported to Foote from Washington, "We all went wild over your success. Uncle Abe was joyful and said everything of the Navy boys and spoke of you in his plain, sensible appreciation of merit and skill." Spirits sagged correspondingly in Confederate circles. Albert Sidney Johnston was dismayed by the severe damage to his defensive line, informing his Richmond superiors that Fort Donelson was not long tenable. After debating whether to withdraw altogether, Johnston now made a fatal, half-hearted decision, sending only 12,000 men to Fort Donelson to withstand Grant's advance. Once Grant made short work of Fort Henry, he was ready to do the same for nearby Fort Donelson. On February 10th, he gathered officers aboard his steamer for a rare council of war. In general, Grant avoided such meetings, believing the fewer people privy to a secret, the better its safety, but this time he made an exception. "The question for consideration, gentlemen, is whether we shall march against Fort Donelson or wait for reinforcements," Grant announced. "I should like to have your views." As each officer spoke, Grant puffed meditatively on a meerschaum pipe, while Rawlins stared hard, sizing up each speaker. For anybody who knew Grant's nature, it was certain that he would opt for immediate action instead of tarrying to await reinforcements. If he allowed his fellow officers to air their views, in the end, he consulted his own intuitions. True to form, Grant concluded by telling his officers to be ready to move at a moment's notice, a position they unanimously endorsed. In the flush of victory, Halleck still meditated what the Confederates might do to Grant rather than what Grant might do to them. He chose to regard Grant as a rival and a threat rather than as a valued extension of his own power and secretly connived to replace Grant with another general. "Hold on to Fort Henry at all hazards," he notified Grant. "Impress slaves of secessionists in vicinity to work on fortifications." It was a perfect example of the timid, static thinking favored by a desk-bound general beset by fears. With perhaps a touch of sarcasm, Grant told Halleck that "there are no Negroes in this part of the country to work on fortifications." Never one to look back, his self-confidence growing daily, Grant had little time for Halleck's instinctive caution. His style as a commander, scrappy, mobile, opportunistic, was maturing. With his sights set on Fort Donelson, he wanted to maintain the winning tempo of his campaign, to keep the ball moving as lively as possible, as he phrased it. He had developed a bracing self-reliance as a commander and had learned, if necessary, to operate on his own. "General Halleck did not approve or disapprove of my going to Fort Donelson," Grant later wrote. "He said nothing whatever to me on the subject."